Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. In one of our earliest podcasts for Merely Catholic, we looked at the crisis at St. John Fisher School in Purley, where a gay activist used the Lord's Prayer as a framework he twisted into erotic teen gay porn to be read to the children. And after a fierce struggle between sympathetic and disturbed parents, sympathetic and disturbed governors, a pro-LGBT strike by teachers, and the courageous intervention of the Archbishop of Southwark, the integrity of Catholic culture was successfully defended, but only just. And in the aftermath, the gay head of department who'd arranged for his gay companion and campaigning literary friend to come in to give his erotic readings admitted that part of the motivation had been to push the boundaries to see how far Catholic culture was willing to bend. Sadly, the Catholic Education Service put upon themselves to issue an apology to the whole LGBTQI++ community for any pain they vicariously suffered during the dispute. It was an indication, if one was needed, of how far Catholic professional educators had capitulated to the secular drive to sexualise children. But there was no apology to faithful Catholic parents or teachers who were shocked and distressed at this abuse of the Lord's Prayer as a vehicle for teenage gay grooming. Many Catholic parents looked with distress on the state of Catholic education today and wonder if there's any safe spaces that allow their children to be educated in an environment where Catholic values are safeguarded and even treasured. Homeschooling is an option that many parents are exploring, with American Catholics leading the way in setting up franchises of education whose structures and practices can be replicated. But in France, in La Vendée, another experiment in Catholic education is taking place at the Chavagne International College. Its headmaster and founder is an Englishman called Ferdy McDermott. He bought a vacant seminary in the heart of a French town in La Vendée and created a Catholic International Academy. Daily Mass is in Latin, and over the last two decades, the school has produced more than 20 vocations to the priesthood, a figure that few formerly Catholic secondary schools in the UK could match. Ferdy McDermott takes the view that Catholic primary education is still a fairly safe space in the UK, but secondary education remains increasingly problematic, which is a situation he set up the Chavagne International College to solve. I wanted to ask him how his experiment has worked and what he thought the issues for Catholic educators looked like from his vantage point. And he joins me now. Ferdy, thank you for joining me today. It's really lovely to have you here on the podcast. And when I visited the Chavagne International College recently, I was enormously impressed at what I saw there. I asked you for directions and you said you can't miss it. It's right in the middle of the village square. And so it was. It's an enormous and very impressive building. I think you told me it's a former seminary or junior seminary, obviously right at the heart of this town. We're going to be discussing theories of Catholic education in a contested society. Could you tell me what it was that took you there? What's the journey from where you began, I think, in Edinburgh, to becoming headmaster of what is a really very impressive and highly interesting international Catholic college in the La Vendée in France?
Well, thank you, Gavin, for having me. Yes, it's a pleasure to be on your podcast. And it's true, I began my journey, my adult journey anyway, in Edinburgh, where I was for 4 years until 1995. And then in my final year at university, having had a first desire to join the priesthood when I was finding my work difficult in my first year, and I thought perhaps I could run away. And I was persuaded to finish my degree, and so I did. I applied for the priesthood for the Diocese of Portsmouth. Was something that had been at the back of my mind as a child. I'd had other ambitions, perhaps the law. I had a girlfriend at university. I thought perhaps about marriage. But the idea of the priesthood was always in the back of my mind. So I applied for the priesthood, and it didn't really work out. I was sent to be a pastoral assistant in a parish, and I left after a couple of weeks. But at the same time, I in my final year at university, I'd got involved in a little bit of Catholic hack journalism. writing, you know, articles for different Catholic publications for money. And
what you're describing is the way I spend my life at the moment. Yeah, so gently.
So you're not going to look down on this humble start in the sort of lay apostle's life. So that's the way I started. And then I developed an idea with a friend that I would start a magazine for Catholic schools, because I had a bit of a bee in my bonnet about Catholic education, even though I, as a cradle Catholic, I'd been to an Anglican private school growing up. And I remember when I went to see my old favourite teacher at school, and I told him I was going in for the priesthood. He said, "Well, I hope you can do something about education, Catholic education." And that was my idea, was that a lot of young men going in for the priesthood have a bit of an agenda, don't they?
They do. They may do. That's what the bishop said. They may do.
So anyway, my agenda, I had one, and my agenda was, I'll go in for the priesthood, and maybe I can do something about Catholic education, because I had had friends who were also cradle Catholics and then went into the official Catholic education system and either had a lot of complaints to make about it or just lost their faith from a position of being quite pious, really. And my experience of a good Anglican school, King Edward VI in Southampton, was that we had a good Bible education, and we were encouraged. I was encouraged in my Catholic faith. I was encouraged to defend it. So that was my background there, really, in school terms. And so I started a magazine called Mentor, the Catholic Education Journal, which was a bit cheeky of me. I was a young man of 22 or something like that. And I sent it out to every school, Catholic school in the UK, and including Scotland. And there was about 4,000 schools. It was sold on the back of advertising. I had various other young bucks and ladies involved in Catholic education who were writing articles for me. I was selling advertising and writing pompous editorials, you see. So this went on for a few years. I also then started in the 96 a publishing house publishing books called St. Austin Press. We published about 50 books. And the Catholic Teachers Journal went on for 7 or 8 years. And involved my going to visit various schools to write what we call advertorial. You know, they would, the Catholic newspapers know about this. So I would be writing about a school's new theatre that they'd built or something. They would give me the list of suppliers. I'd call them all and get them to buy advertising to support the Catholic Teachers magazine, you see. And through being in this network, and then also very much in the spirit of Newman, who wanted an educated Catholic laity, this was really the kind of thrust of these publishing activities in the 90s, when there wasn't really much Catholic publishing going on in Britain. The Catholic Truth Society then had just gone back to publishing leaflets. And it was a time there was Family Publications was another one. There was Grace Wing. The editor of Grace Wing became a Catholic. And there were sort of rumblings in the world of Catholic publishing, but we were there at the time when it was sort of coming back, having really had its heyday in the 50s, in the days of Burns and Oates and Sheed and Ward. So out of the magazine for Catholic schools, Mentor, Catholic Education Journal, came a sort of conspiracy, really, to found a Catholic school that would do the job. And, of course, that was perhaps a bit of an arrogant thing to say, but I remember, for example, meeting with heads of some of the independent schools who at the time were writing articles in the national press about a need to return to Catholic faith rather than Catholic values, you know, and how the children in their schools would at least know their catechism and so on. So there was an appetite in the Catholic independent schools in the 1990s for a return to a more meaty religious education and Catholic ethos in the schools. And my idea was really originally to start a Catholic school in London, perhaps a day school. Of course, it was too expensive, so we were looking further afield. And eventually, after lots of calls to estate agents and bishops and begging for a bit of money, I ended up with my dad and my mum, and 9 or 10 friends, including two families who came over, one from Zimbabwe and one from London, with their kids. And we started a school for 10 pupils, originally 10 boys from different countries, one priest and one retired Christian brother who was a former contributor to the magazine. And that was the beginning of our adventure in 2002. So we've been here for 22 years.
You didn't start the school in the UK. You started it in France, or?
No, we started it in France because, well, at the time, a lot of English people were selling up their homes in the south of England and buying chateaus in France. And, you know, the EU was a thing. Moving about was quite easy. And the idea of going to France wasn't as bold a step as it might be today. And in fact, for the first 2 years, in our second year, for example, we had about 25, 26 pupils. 20 of them were from the UK.
Right. And French property prices were of an entirely different nature, weren't they?
They were. There was an enormous gap between the two. And France was very much, the feel of France was, you know, it was a long way behind the UK in terms of its societal and moral collapse. That was the feeling of France. People still would take a couple of hours for lunch and so on, you know, whereas in England, a quick sandwich.
I learned all I know about La Vendée from reading Trollope. And then lately, of course, as I've reread history as a Catholic, been delighted and impressed at the way in which La Vendée remained an area of traditional faith. And we might talk about the way in which your diocese has responded to Fetusio Supplicans later on as a way of taking the temperature of the place you're involved in. But did you choose La Vendée as an area of France because of its Catholic faithfulness, or was it just a kind of happy synchronicity?
I think it was synchronicity or serendipity. Of course, you know, when we found out about the history of the Vendée, which really, to be honest, was when I was visiting this school with some friends and colleagues, future friends and future colleagues. The story of the Vendée was told to me, and of course I'd never learnt it at school. And we thought, well, you know, this must be a sign. this is a part of France that, after the French Revolution, was actually in alliance with England, although it didn't really come to very much. And the local people here had been prepared to give their lives for their freedom to worship in the Catholic faith, which had been denied them by the French Revolution.
Well, they experienced very severe massacres at the hands both of the French revolutionary forces, and also the young Napoleon was sent to quash the Catholics, and he did a rather brutal job. So they paid a very high price, didn't they, in terms of their fidelity to the Catholic Church?
Yes, and it was because of Napoleon's experience that he said, I never want Frenchmen to be killing other Frenchmen in this way again. You know, on the 24th of February, 1794, so we're getting ready for an anniversary in a few weeks' time, there were several hundred, as many as 400, from this little village massacred in one day by the Republican troops. And there were mostly men, women. There were mostly women and children and elderly, because the men were hiding in the woods with their weapons and so on. There were examples around here also of people being packed into the church and the church set on fire, so on. So we're looking at a kind of Bosnia-type situation. You know, there was definitely an attempt at ethnic cleansing of the Vendeans, who had in 1793, so 4 years after the storming of the Bastille, they had, instead of answering the national conscription to fight against all France's neighbours, they decided that they were, all the young men around here, and old men and ladies too, that they would fight for Louis the 17th, the little boy in prison, and for freedom of religion, because their priests were either being drowned or strangled or exiled to Spain. There was 1 year in France, for example, where there was no Easter Triduum celebrated in France by any priest in union with Rome. And there were cathedrals where the goddess of reason was enthroned on the altar and so on. So that's the context that we're in, especially the Loire, which is the river north of here, going through Nantes. There were hundreds of priests and nuns drowned in the Loire. So that was what people were rising up against. And of course that was an inspiration to us, and still is, because it marks the landscape. This part of France is a little bit like the west of Ireland or Poland. There are crucifixes and shrines of Our Lady at every street corner.
And a place of martyrdom, which has, I think, serious implications not only for historical memory, but also for contemporary ongoing spirituality.
Sure, sure. And also the Vendée, we, as we discovered after the first few weeks, the symbol of the Vendée was the two hearts, and still is. You see it on every bus stop. also the politics of the Vendée was, and to a certain extent still is, of a conservative, somewhat pro-life, even pro-culture hue. And so our reception here from the civic authorities, as well as the ecclesiastical ones, was very positive. And so all that turned out to be good news for us. And we were supported very strongly, particularly by our local government of the Vendée.
So my rather casual reference to synchronicity, which is unfortunately Jungian, really ought to be replaced with providence and grace and guidance. I mean, it sounds a wonderful match, two expressions of Catholic fidelity and meeting and marrying across time, and to great effect.
Yeah, you know, it was about 1802 was when a young priest who'd been exiled to Spain for his refusal to swear the oath of loyalty to the government and rejection of the Pope. He came back then in secret. He opened his junior seminary here, which was in fact a major seminary as well for a few years. And then 200 years later, the building was empty, and we came at the invitation of the bishop and started again. And the funny thing is, we discovered then that in our altar, a number of us are Irish. I'm half Irish. In our altar was an Irish saint from the 8th century.
Good grief.
So,
wow.
A little bit of home.
Yes. So you began, you found the building in a place of really quite powerful significance, and certainly in a political environment in your terms of European politics, which was easier than it is today. How did you market yourself to the Catholic Church, both in England and abroad?
Well, at the time, most of our marketing was in the UK through the Catholic newspapers, which have had a difficult time ever since. And there was a good response through the Catholic Times and the Catholic Herald at that time. And that's why in our second year, we managed to get 20 UK pupils. And in our third year, it was about the same. But then really what happened was from 2008, after the financial crash, it was quite difficult for us to recruit English pupils in quite the same way. I think also we tapped in 2002, 2003, 2004, we tapped into a sizable but disorganized homeschooling movement in the UK amongst faithful Catholics. And so a lot of our initial pupils were boys of 13, 14, 15 who had been homeschooled by mum and were a bit sick of it.
And also needed a platform. Also needed a platform for serious qualifications. So is that...
That was important consideration for them, was to get GCSEs and A-levels.
Yeah. Right. Have we got back to that point now? I mean, I'm a recent arrival on the Catholic educational scene in terms of my own personal experience, but it seems to me these things are usually cyclical, aren't they? And we're entering either a new crisis or a deepening of the old crisis. There's a lot more talk about home education, and certainly what's happening at the hands of the state. I mean, one needs to be too graphic, but the compulsory sexual education and the sexualizing of children that's begun in the last couple of years is alarming to all parents, let alone Catholic ones. So is your understanding of what's going on, at least in English education for Catholics, a deepening of the crisis or the beginning of a new cycle? How do you read what's happening?
Well, I think perhaps we're going back there again in terms of a crunch with what's happening in schools, but the homeschooling movement in the UK is better organized than it was. There are a number of good projects, such as the Regina Chaley Academy system. They have a couple of branches now, I think, in the UK, which are adapting the American homeschooling resources and model to a UK market. And so that small and enthusiastic market of a few hundred families is already responding quite well to that. I think there's still the same problem amongst these people of how do we get them GCSEs and A-levels? So that's an issue. But I think there's also a disillusionment amongst idealistic middle-class people with private education, because private schools in England now, why would you send your child to a private school? Mainly for social reasons, I think.
One of the things that impressed me so much when I came to visit the school was kind of the very natural and easygoing camaraderie. There was this must obviously be a tribute to you and your colleagues, but presumably one of the most important things that an enterprise like yours offers is the opportunity for socialization, that children who are being schooled within the four walls of home, even if they do it collectively with other people, can't achieve in the same way.
I think that's true. And I think if I were to compare, the middle class and aristocratic French Catholic milieu with what might exist in England, there are families who are very much devoted to their faith and want a good education for their children, but they struggle to find Catholic schools where their children will make good Catholic friends. In France, it's a bit different, because in France, there is still quite a strong culture of private Catholic schools that do provide good Catholic friends who will keep each other on the straight and narrow. And we're somewhere between the two, because we're providing a network that our pupils plug into, and they stay friends through university and on into adult life. We can see that. I mean, I get the marriage invitations and things like that, and I meet up with pupils again. And this is a sort of pan-European, even international. We have American pupils and Australians here as well sometimes, and we've got one American boy at the moment and even a Chinese boy. So there's that network, that socialization, but it's also what the French call la saine émulation. The younger boys emulating the older ones. And you mentioned vocations.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. What's been your experience with the production of vocations in the school?
Yeah, well, it's not a factory, so we're not trying to produce them. But it's true that the boys don't grumble as much as you would imagine about having to go to daily mass. They get used to it. They like it. It's the one time when they're calm. The rest of the day, they're always running around making a lot of noise. But they appreciate that oasis of calm and spirituality. They get used to it. They miss it, they say, sometimes when they're on holiday and they're feeling a bit listless. There's that time, our mass is in the middle of the day. We used to have it early in the morning, but in the middle of the day, everything stops. And almost all of them like serving mass, and they queue up to serve mass. They even sometimes fight to get on the list. And from the very beginning, some of our early pupils in the first two or three years are now priests. And so that's sort of set a ball rolling. And just like interest in A-level subjects tends to go in waves, sometimes it's humanities, sometimes it's maths and physics, and because they emulate the boys in the year above them. There is a bit of that, definitely. And we've even had, for example, one brother join a seminary, and then the other brother copy his big brother, and so on. So, but the boys are all like brothers, really, and they get used to the idea of being close to the liturgy, close to the sacraments. And of course, there's also a sort of sense of commitment to a cause. Without our wanting to be isolationist or polemical in any way, the boys do realize that our school is different, and they do really realize that society is in a state of crisis, and they do realize that there are wars and rumors of wars everywhere, because we're all, we pray for peace. And a number of our pupils are actually from Ukraine or from the Middle East, even a couple from Russia, and they're here because of these societal problems. And I think they do believe, aside from their deep theological convictions, which they may or may not have, they do believe that the world would be a better place if if it lived in a caring and loving and Christian manner. And so they think, well, we've got to keep this show on the road. You know, who's going to keep the show on the road for the next generation? So I'm sure there's a bit of that, but then there's also individual prayer life. You know, we do have boys who hang around in the chapel after Mass, hang around after night prayers. There are confessions every day. You know, there are little boys who get into the habit of going into confession once a week or once a month or once a fortnight. And then when they get into their teenage years and it gets a bit more difficult, well, they've got the habit built up.
I don't want to be too personal, but one of the things that made it quite difficult for me to be a Christian in the first place was the fact of my experience of chaplains at an Anglican public school. I found them sub-masculine, sub-strong, sub all kinds of things. And I don't mean to be too personal, it's not fair, so I won't say where it was. But they really became a barrier between me and my understanding, I think, of you know, their impersona Christi was not very effective. So when I became a Christian, I looked back and thought, what a wasted opportunity. And so as a former Anglican clergyman and somebody who's got his own views on chaplaincy, I have to say, I was very impressed with the two chaplains I met, who you had. I thought they were just splendid. I don't mean to flatter, but they were clever, brave, alert, and impressive. And I think if I'd grown up with chaplains like this, I think I'd have my chances of coming to the faith earlier would have been greatly improved, and also of a sort of the experience of a more testing adolescence too. I thought that was really sort of quite important. The other thing I was very surprised at was when I walked into Mass, you have the Latin Mass, and you know that's going to involve conversations about your diocese and La Vendée. So can you just tell me a little bit, how is it you have the Latin Mass? There can't be many schools in England that retain the Latin Mass as you do, or even that are lucky enough, blessed enough, to have the quality of priests that you have serving. When did you take the decision that you'd be faithful to Latin, and what are the implications of that for the children?
Well, I'll be completely straight with you and say that, 22 years ago, our thought was, let's have the Mass of Paul VI in Latin, but also have the what we call the old Mass, the Tridentine Mass as well, because under John Paul II, it was becoming more freely available. And so when we asked for it in the first month that we were here, we said, is it all right if we have the old Mass too? And the bishop said, it's inopportune. So, but we were having the new Mass in Latin, and he said, you can have the new Mass in Latin ad orientem, and that'll be fine. So we did. And he knew that just from my publishing projects, which were kind of thoroughly researched by the French bishops before they would let us come to France, they knew that we were kind of close to Cardinal Ratzinger and his thought on these questions about Christian culture and about liturgy and so on. And so towards the end of our first year, we said to the bishop, you know, we're going on the Chartres pilgrimage. Will you give us permission to celebrate the Pentecost octave with the old Mass, just to kind of bask in the afterglow of the Chartres pilgrimage? And he was so happy with our first year and how we got on. He said, yes, you do, so that's fine. And next year, if you want to celebrate the old Mass twice a week, that'll be fine as well. So it was a sort of a test period. And then the next bishop we had after that said, you can celebrate the old Mass as much as you like. So we did. And for a long time, it was about 50-50. Now, during COVID, when the school almost died, because imagine the fate of an international institution when you can't travel anymore, it was really, I think, in the context of sort of uncertainty and wanting to have a clear message and so on, we decided, with a kind of odd timing, that we would, I hope you don't mind my saying like this, would go more trad. So we went more trad.
I don't I'm the scientist. I think people are very interested to hear.
We still have a Mass in English from time to time, but we essentially the daily Mass is this, the Tridentine Mass now, and our Sunday Mass too. And we've been very careful about not upsetting anybody and any bishops. We get on well with all the local clergy. We've sort of stood the test of time, and they respect us and we respect them. And I mean, I don't want to get our bishop into trouble, but shortly, just a matter of weeks after this decision was made, a document came out from Rome then saying that you shouldn't really be having the old mass anymore, which was a shock to us, because under Benedict XVI, that with Summorum Pontificum, that's when we had decided to sort of open up in that direction. And of course, my experience under Benedict XVI's pontificate as a headmaster of this kind of uber Catholic school, if you like, was that there was I being very Irenic in the middle, having both forms of the Mass, also having Easter liturgies as well, sometimes, which the boys found fascinating. And yet all the boys would say, oh, yeah, well, we prefer the Tridentine Mass.
Seriously?
Yes, they'd all say that. And of the vocations we've had one boy or teacher entering in seminary for every year we've been here, and they are all attracted to the Tridentine Mass, even though, you know, one or two of them have gone to diocese. Most of them have gone to the Fraternity of St. Peter, the Institute of Christ the King, the Institute of the Good Shepherd, or whatever. They've gone to orders where they can say the old Mass. So it does hold an attraction. It holds an attraction for boys, definitely.
If you've been there over 20 years, I mean, 20 how many years?
22.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, in terms of vocations produced, that compares quite favourably to most of the Catholic schools that I know of.
Well, yes, I'm not counting. We've got about six or seven in seminary at the moment. So, you know, as time goes on, there are more. Some of them drop out, but you know, each year that goes by, there's another priest or two. So that's a lovely thing.
So let me ask a political. I don't want to cause any political trouble, but let me ask a common sense question. If you're producing, I mean, you called it uber Catholic, but that's a bit self-deprecatory. It's just. It's normally Catholic. If you're producing vocations at this steady rate, why aren't there more bishops looking at you saying, this is really a very workable model for us in Europe, I don't know, in the UK, in France. Obviously, the EU has made, the developments you've made things more difficult. But are you an embarrassment because the hierarchy is not as proud of its own roots as it might be, or are you a shining beacon for others? I know that we really, obviously, there's a civil war taking place culturally right throughout the whole of our society, obviously reflected within the Catholic Church. How does that leave you? Because in other circumstances, you would be presumably a beacon of educational success, culturally as well as intellectually.
I would say that a lot of Catholics and Catholic priests, we have lots of Catholic priests and a few bishops who follow us on social media and like what we do and so on, and who have reached out to us. And I would say that they do respect and admire what we're doing. We respect and admire them. But probably they think, you know, however they've managed to do it, it's just too difficult to do it that way. You know, it's the real old style. Also, they would guess quite rightly that it's exhausting to have to work in it's exhausting but rewarding to provide this kind of education. We had an experience when we took the boys on a choir trip to Sicily a few years ago, and we stayed in a junior seminary that had just closed and was still being used for various diocesan functions. And it was also the major seminary, with two buildings joined together. And the bishop gave a talk in Italian. There was a translator there. It was like going to a papal audience or something. The Italian bishops, they still have this sense of being princes, you know. And he was sitting in his throne, and he was delivering this sort of encyclical about faith and culture and what have you. And he said, Dottore Madermot, and he said, come to Sicilia. He said, il mio seminario è alla sua disposizione. My seminary is at your disposition. Come and found an international college in our town. And it got in the local newspaper. It said, you know, Collegio Inglese coming to Trapani which of the town where all the mafia money was in the bank. So that's what was said at the time. And people said to me at the time, do you know, if the bishop thinks it's a good idea because he's the best businessman in town.
The grief. The mind boggles, not short of sponsorship.
Yeah. We had a similar really friendly, warm welcome in Sweden. We went there, this was about 20 years ago. It's the same bishop there, Anders Arborelius, he's a convert. He a number of years ago, he was on EWTN, gave some reflections on Carmelite spirituality in English and in Spanish. A great man. And you know, wherever we've been, the bishops have been quite fascinated by what we do. We went to Estonia there. There's a Frenchman who's a bishop in Estonia. But I think probably people just sort of think, well, it's not really possible to do that in the modern world. Having said that, there are a few schools in America that are sort of trying to do what we're doing. There's one called St. Martin's Academy, who their boys came to visit us. They've been going for about 10 years. In France, I'd say the one thing that differentiates us from French traddie or conservative Catholic boarding schools is that I don't know of any other school that has daily mass for all the kids. I don't know. I mean, that they used to exist, but that doesn't happen anymore. I think also it's rare in France and in continental Europe in general to have boarding schools with all the bells and whistles, you know, that are busy at the weekend. Most of the boarding schools that I know in France, the children go home at the weekend, which sort of saps the energy from mass serving, choir singing, and so on, if you're not there on a Sunday.
Yes, you're just left with the treadmill of Monday to Friday, aren't you?
Yeah, and also because you've got to catch the train on Monday and Friday and so on, there has to be a lot of study in the evenings. You know, I would say we had a great sermon today at Mass because we were celebrating the Feast of St. John Bosco, and it was all about let boys be boys, you know. And that's part of it, really, and that's one of the things that we can offer.
But, I mean, there are two questions I don't want to lose sight of. The first one is, given the fairly harsh and rigorous secular grip that we experience in the UK, how do you get on with the French authorities? One might have thought that in a more overtly secular society, they would be more aggressive or controlling. And secondly, I was going to ask you if you then consider, as we wrap up the conversation, how you see the future of Catholic education, certainly in England, because you'll obviously keep close tabs on what's happening here, but maybe in Europe too. And one of the, just in brackets, one of the things that I think the lens through which I see some of all this is the clash of civilizations, the whole quest to preserve what we can of Christendom under some very serious and rather aggressive competition. So first of all, the French authorities, what are your dealings with them like?
Well, I think initially and for a number of years, they sort of thought we were a bit strange and we were c'est les Anglais, and they sort of left us alone. But just a few months after Benedict XVI was elected, somebody from the French version of MI5 came to visit me, called the Renseignement Général. And he said it was just a courtesy visit. but by the end of the meeting, he said, "Oh, so I'll just say that." So he was writing a report, obviously, for someone, and he asked us what language the Mass was in and all that. And when I told him about it, he said, "Well, I suppose that's okay because Benedict XVI, it's not too extreme now. It's all kind of out of the woods on that question." And I was quite surprised that the state would be meddling, you know, in our religious practices. But he was quite a nice man, you know. Nothing bad happened after that meeting. I'd say, and also for the longest time, the French government, because of the code of education that Napoleon put in place after the civil war that there had been in the Vendée and so on, gave the church basically a lot of liberty, although there was some destabilizing that happened in 1905 and there was separation of church and state. Basically, the code of education does not allow or did not allow the state to interfere with private schools. So there was hardly any inspection at all. So we weren't properly inspected until the last 6 or 7 years, because then suddenly the government started to get worried about what they call dérive sectaire, sectarianism. But in fact, in practice, what happened was they started then to get worried about conservative Catholic schools being a kind of divisive subculture that might, you know, produce terrorists or extremists or whatever. So that's been a preoccupation for the last decade or so. Now, we've been inspected twice in the last 5 years. Both times were surprise inspections, which are quite stressful. You don't get those in the UK. They give you at least, you know, a day or two's notice. And the last inspection, they came in with five inspectors, and it was quite a thorough inspection. And we're expecting them again this year sometime. So we need to be ready. So that's, and they don't do that with their own state schools, but there's definitely at the moment a sense in which they're out to get private schools, which has us a bit scared, but, you know, we're ready for them. So that's okay. We've an eye on the next election, the next presidential election in France, because if this trajectory against private education continues, it's a little bit like the situation in Britain. I mean, if Labour gets in the UK, private schools will get the squeeze. That, of course, that may be good for us. If there's VAT on school fees in the UK, we might pick up a few pupils. But in general, the state is getting more and more interested in what's happening in private schools. And also, homeschooling has been banned in France. This is the first year when there's no homeschooling at all now in France. It's finished.
Yes, that's extraordinary, isn't it? That's quite incredible and a really rather alarming development. I mean, without wanting to place faithful Catholics on either side of the political spectrum, is there any chance of a swing of the pendulum away from the left to an administration that might be more favourable to what you stand for?
Well, I mean, I don't want to get into French politics. I'm applying for French citizenship after 22 years, so I may end up voting in 2027.
Then let's not talk about it.
I mean, I can. I mean, it seems to me that if Marine Le Pen is elected, which seems quite possible now, that private schools will get their freedom back, you know, and that I'm not saying I would agree with her on all of her policies, but, you know, in my own backyard of education, there would certainly be more freedom there. But that would be true of any right of centre, Les Républicains, you know, I don't know what they're called now, but the Chirac and Sarkozy and all that, they were quite friendly to private schools. But it's quite possible, because they've talked about it, that if Le Pen got in, that they could have even, you know, the school check, where parents could just choose whichever school they wanted and pay with government money. So that would be, of course, a revolution in education. I mean, these are difficult times. I mean, and in the church as well, you know, we don't like to be polemical, but, you know, we're watchful. It was interesting, you mentioned it, about fiducia supplicans. This is a difficult thing in a Catholic school, a boys' school, of course, to explain what's happening to the boys, because they, you know, like the Africans who say we're too simple to understand this document. The boys say, Mr. McDermott, what does this mean? You know, we're just as stumped as the next man. But in this diocese, there are 9 dioceses in this province have said there to be no blessings of any kind of irregular couples or unions at all in this part of France. So it doesn't apply here.
Let me take you away from your application for French citizenship. I don't want to put you on difficult ground. How do you see things developing in the UK? Because, I mean, one of our experiences, particularly after there was a debacle in the Archdiocese of Southwark, the Catholic establishment is closer to progressive educational culture than many parents are comfortable with. There doesn't seem to be quite enough space between them. Can Catholic education survive with any integrity if it accepts the philosophical worldview of a fairly anti-Christian progressive utopianism, which is where we are at the moment? Do you have any views on the outcome of the trajectory that we face here? I mean, particularly if there's another, a more articulate left-wing government.
I mean, the short answer to your question is, can it survive, is no. But having said that, although my experience of, you know, being friendly and meeting a lot of people involved in private education in the UK is that most private schools in the UK, Catholic ones, have sold out, I'm afraid to say, because they need the money. Also, what I have noticed, to my surprise and delight, is that there are a lot of young teachers around going into education in Catholic state schools who are very well intentioned. And a lot of good things are happening, particularly at the primary level, because a primary school is a small kingdom and you can get things done. But the big problem of the Catholic education system in the UK is it's become a social institution. People send their kids there because the schools are quieter, they have better pastoral care, people are more friendly, the results are better. And so these schools are competing in an educational market with the publication of league tables and all that sort of thing. Everybody's looking at the bottom line. There's a crisis of leadership in Catholic schools. It's very difficult to find good heads. Some schools wonder, you know, shall we appoint a Baptist or a Methodist or something, because they can't find a Catholic who's got any leadership potential. There's also this question of the Catholic teacher contract, where, you know, can we really hold the line of saying that we're not going to have divorced and remarried or transgender or active homosexual leaders in Catholic schools? I mean, and a lot of schools, there's been blood on the carpet there on those issues. So all of these problems are to do with the fact that Catholic education in the UK is a juggernaut, and it's just difficult to slow it down or change its direction. It seems to me they're the younger generation, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, anybody who's interested in any way, shape, or form in the priesthood, Catholic education, religious life, they're all conservative. They all, or even reactionary, all of them. I mean, there are very, very few exceptions. But can they change the direction of the juggernaut? Probably not. Probably the way that good things are going to happen is in the creation of new small schools, the conversion of existing schools, if politics will allow it, into academies or free schools, things like that. Grassroots movement from the very real effect of the Génération Jean-Paul II, Génération Benoît XVI. I mean, those people, that's my generation. These people, if they want to get involved in the church, it's because they believe. And you're not going to give your life to sort of a social services institution. Maybe people a little bit older who are still sort of the hippie generation, maybe. But the younger generation, there's a lot of hope there, but the institutions are sort of rotten on the inside. And I'm not talking about the church. I'm talking about the, you know, the structures of Catholic education. Probably there'll have to be some dying back and then growing back with new green shoots. But you can see it happening. But there will be some suffering. You were talking about the crisis in the Southwark Diocese with the school. In fact, we picked up a pupil as a result of that. But I think now also the Catholic bishops in the UK, they've made a number of mistakes in not asking, for example, for derogations from various government policies about sex education in schools, for example, where they had some scope to ask for those derogations. I think now that they've realised that they need to stand up for themselves. But when you talk to individual bishops, they themselves are frustrated by this juggernaut effect. That and I remember speaking to a Catholic bishop about this not so long ago, and he said, "You overestimate my authority."
Well, yes, I'm afraid that's true. There's a complex relationship between the Catholic Education Service and the bishops and their diocesan responsibilities. I mean, it's not for us at the moment to engage in critical analysis of those politics. But you're quite right. The scope for standing up for Catholic culture is I'm sure it's more narrow than we'd like it to be. But the difficulty is that the secular culture takes no prisoners. It offers no compromises of its own. And so inevitably, if you don't stand up against it, you go with it. And then there is, you know, your Catholic education isn't worth the paper it's written on. Certainly doesn't deliver.
If I were a dad in the UK at the moment, I'm not a dad, as far as I know, I would send them to a good Catholic primary school. They do exist. And because I know people who are going into primary education and really they have a lot of freedom to do a very good job. I'd send them to a good Catholic primary school, and probably I would then decide to send them to a secondary school where they would have good company, they'd stay off drugs, you know, they would be aspirational. And I wouldn't necessarily say you must send them to a Catholic school, because if the Catholic school is just a sink, then why bother, really?
Well, not only that, but we both know that it poses a great danger of inoculating you against both Christianity and Catholicism, and so it becomes more problematic than helpful. Ferdy, I've taken up a lot of your time. We've spoken at length. Thank you very much for doing this. It's been extremely interesting.
It's been a pleasure for me, Gavin. Lovely to speak with you. And it was lovely to welcome you to our school, and you're always welcome to come and visit us again in the future.
I look forward to it very much. Ferdy McDermott, thank you. It's been really a marvellous conversation. Very grateful. God bless you.
God bless you. Thank you.